Good morning. We'd like to welcome everyone to this morning's study session from Mesa City Council for Thursday, March 22nd, 2012. And we'd like to, first of all, begin by giving a very extra special welcome to some visitors we have. We are fortunate this week to have visitors from one of our sister cities, Burnaby, British Columbia, Canada. Good day, eh? Hey, that's a bad Canadian. That was really bad. I feel like a hoser. I feel like a hoser, yeah, hey. No, we are so grateful to have Burnaby. For those of who may not know, Burnaby is I like to call him the Mesa of Vancouver. Very, very nice city in the Vancouver metro area, and we've had the opportunity to visit them about a year and a half ago, and they are returning the pleasure. I think this is the first time in about 4 years. And we are very grateful to have now. This is what I love. The mayor of Burnaby, his worship, Mayor Derek Corrigan.
That's not going to happen.
I would like to introduce a motion to change the vernacular. I would do a little bit of a change, though. I would say that in Mesa it should be his worship, the Lord Mayor of Mesa.
I have an amended motion.
you're out of order, Vice Mayor. Mayor Corrigan, welcome. And we also have some counselors, Paul McDonald, Paul, and Nick Volkow. Nick's back there. We have some other dignitaries from that. And I'm sorry, Balzinger Narang, the chair of the Burnaby Board of Education, thank you. Paul Holden, president and CEO of the Board of Trade. Wilf Hurd, the director of government relations. There's Wilf. Bob Moncur, the city manager. Last night, Bob and Chris Brady were over there, and I have no idea what they were talking about, and I didn't want to know. But they were doing city manager kind of stuff. Chad Turpin, deputy city manager. Chad, frequent visitor. Used to own a condo in the area, as a matter of fact, here. We find that a lot from our friends in Canada, that a lot of them know the Valley and Mesa and Scottsdale. Basil Luxon, the director of planning and building. And Marianne Manuel, there you are, Marianne. Thank you so very much. I didn't know that was your last. I just knew her as Marianne. So thank you, Marianne. Thank you so very much for being here. And, they're real troopers to get up this early in the morning. Mayor Corrigan reminded me he never takes an appointment before 10 o'clock in the morning. And I said, that is one smart man. So thank you so very much for getting up and sharing this. And they're going to be here for the next couple, 3 days. And we have a lot of interaction with both our sister cities and city personnel and community leaders, and hope that this is as beneficial as our trip up to Burnaby was, where we can compare notes and learn. And we find that we have a lot more things in common than we have differences, and there's a lot of good ideas that come out. And Burnaby is an absolutely beautiful city with gorgeous parks and a wonderful program for interesting program of how you've developed your park system, and we're actually going to try to emulate that a little bit in some of the things you've done. So welcome. And they'll be here for just a few minutes, and then they're off to their first gig at one of our fire stations. So we'll follow that. Thank you. First item on the agenda is to hear a presentation, discuss, and provide direction on the proposed transit-oriented development project at the existing La Mesita property. Ms. Lewis.
Good morning, Mayor and Council, and thank you very much for having us this morning. We're here to talk about two of the three proposals that the Council agreed to basically negotiate in good faith with for these low-income housing tax credit proposals. We're going to talk this morning about La Mesita and also about the Escobedo project. And the third project will be coming forward to you for some additional discussion and direction next week at study session. We thought it would be good just to start with a little bit of an overview about the purpose of this tax credit program. It's a federal program, and its purpose is that rather than providing some kind of a direct subsidy to investors, it encourages them to invest their private capital in order to develop rental housing, and then they are provided with some credit to offset their tax liabilities, their federal tax liabilities. And so that's how this program works in general. It's a very competitive process, and here in Arizona, the Arizona Department of Housing is responsible for administering the program. In 2012, there were 31 proposals that were submitted statewide. Basically, they are in five different categories. One of them is supportive housing, which is like emergency shelter housing or other special needs and disabilities. There was only one this year, and it was for the La Mesita proposal here in Mesa. The next category is for rural communities, and there were 11. The tribal communities, there was one. Nonprofit is the fourth area. Escobedo is in there. La Mesita is also listed in there as a backup, plus six others. And then there's a general category, and the residences on center that you'll hear about next week were in that category along with 10 others. And the way that this works is this year there's approximately $14 million that's available in these federal tax monies. And what the Arizona Department of Housing does is each year they select at least one supportive housing project, two rural and two tribal. And then and they make sure those receive the funding out of that $14 million allowance. And then with at least 15% of the total dollars need to go to nonprofits. So that can be, you know, if like as in the case of La Mesita, that's a nonprofit, and so if they were to receive the tax credit dollars, that would go toward the 15% allocation. And so if you do some conservative math, and this is just an estimate, about half of the dollars this year could go to those four categories. And that leaves the remaining monies for that general category that we were talking about. And based on the request this year, that's about four, maybe five or six that would be funded. I wanted to go through some key milestones. This is new this year. The Arizona Department of Housing added a jobs category, which allows for about 35 points. And in order to receive those points in this very competitive process, the applicants need to meet these timelines. And so that is why when we came to you on March 1st, there was a very strict timeline. And did my microphone go off? Yeah.
Who's going? Okay, next item.
So the key milestones that they...
The problem is that half the people here didn't even notice your microphone. They really did. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
We were happy about it.
The next milestone that they need to meet is May 1st. And what they have to do is provide or receive city approval on a site plan or a final plat or an equivalent of that. They also have to submit their 100% building and engineering plans and provide evidence of that submittal. And then on July 16th...
Hey, Natalie. I mean, that's like 6 weeks, 5.5 weeks away.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
how does
it
that
is.
Happen?
Many of them are already working on them today. Mm-hmm. Or they're bringing plans from other projects.
Well, but how do you submit 100% building engineering plans for a project that
in six weeks?
I mean, the one we're talking about right now, the La Mesita, that's a fairly complex plan. That far along in the planning and everything?
La Mesita has been working on this for quite some time, and I know that the Escobedo project team has also been working in the community and on concepts and those kinds of things. You know, really, it's up for them. It's up to them to perform. From a city perspective, we're working with them to make sure they understand what we need in order to process this and meet these timelines.
How do we do looking at this time frame, we have city-approved site plan and final plat or equivalent. How do we get that through? Because we're talking P&Z, we're talking everything
by
May 1st.
Maybe John.
That's the first part of the question.
Okay.
The second part of the question is that we don't have development agreements. You're talking down the bottom of the note can be considered by council in June. So are we talking about having final site plan or final plat action prior to having development agreements?
Mayor, Council, our goal actually would be to have substantial completion of those development agreements prior to the submittal, because with many of these developments occurring, at least two of the three occurring on city-owned property, we feel it's very important that what we expect, and we would defer to the council, your interest in the development that will take place on city-owned property. So we are trying, that's why we're here today. You're going to have other presentations, and we expect there will be continual conversation, but we are under a very tight time frame. La Mesita actually was in front of P&Z last night, and received their approval. They had to go at risk because until without that timeline. Now, the other two properties, maybe John can explain the status of the entitlements and what process they would have to go through to at least get to site plan and final plat.
Yes, Mayor and Council, with La Mesita, as City Manager stated, they went to P&Z last night to have a recommendation for approval. They'll be on your agenda for action on April the 23rd. They're the only ones that need to come to Council for any action for the rezoning and site plan. We're jumping into some of the presentation that's coming up, but we'll also be taking them to the Design Review Board at their April 4th meeting and working through some design issues in terms of the aesthetics of the building. And it is a tight time frame, but we have been working with them since the first of the year, and they know they're doing some of these things at risk to get the full plans ready for submittal in May. In terms of the Escobedo project, there are no requirements there for any city processes. Their densities and locations, there's no site plan required, no rezoning required. There may be a need to go to the Board of Adjustment to adjust some of the parking requirements, but that could be handled within the time frames if necessary. The other project here next to Mesa City Plaza requires going to the Planning and Zoning Board only. We have them scheduled for the April 18th hearing for that, and as well as the Design Review Board taking a look at it at their April meeting. So again, they're working at risk based on the ideas that they have to meet those time frames and get the building plan submitted by May 1.
So, Mayor and Council, the question becomes, is we have a process that we consider as the city, as we provide the oversight for zoning and platting, but the question is, what involvement does this body want to have in the design, as the owner's representation of the two properties? I mean, it's one thing to function as the city, and you know, we can go to P&Z without the council, but council also represents the body that owns the property. So that's one of the reasons we're here today, and we're going to be coming back shortly next Thursday with the other proposal, is because we really do need that some direction from council as we negotiate, even in the development agreements, the plats or the layouts, the sites, the configurations of some of these properties, how they're going to phase and how they're going to develop out, because it's not just the interest of the city of any development taking place here, but it's also the interest as the owner of the property, the outcome of these. And so that's why we're bringing these to you as quickly as we can, identifying those issues. If we can let us go through the presentations, and I think you'll see there'll be a variety of other issues you'll probably want to ask questions, and then we can try to address them all at the same time, if that would be helpful. But
no, that's
whatever
fine.
You'd like
this
to
just
do.
Jumped out at
no,
me.
No, I agree. That's why we wanted to put it out there.
And I mean, it's different for, like you said, for La Mesita, because it's their property they're redeveloping, but I see those dates out there, and we're talking about some significant decisions, especially as it relates to city-owned property.
Absolutely.
And, that's a little unnerving. So go ahead.
Okay, so July 16th is when they are required to provide evidence of site ownership, and that's in the form of a property deed or an executed lease. And as we've already talked about, that would mean we'd really need to bring the final draft development and lease and purchase agreements to the city council in the June time period in order for us to meet that deadline. On October 18th is when the civil engineering and building permits are due to allow construction to move forward. And then on November 1st, they're required to commence construction. And the Department of Housing actually recommends or actually asks for them to have a certified architect demonstrate that there's meaningful construction underway. And then the next year, December 31st, 2013, is when they need their CFO, their certificate of occupancy.
Hey, Natalie, if I could, I just want to back up, and this has nothing to do with it, but this is for our friends from Burnaby. The four incredible people in front of you are our city employees. Natalie and Trish Sorensen, raise your hand, Trish, are with the city manager's office. Christine Solanka is the director of our development sustainability department. And John Wesley is our planning director. So just wanted to introduce you to them.
Well, and I'm glad that you did, because the way that we are managing these projects is we've identified leads for each of them. And so the last few weeks, what we've been doing is going through sort of discovery phase with these teams. And so they have been, the applicants have been honing their applications and bringing them forward as they can. We have been just digging in and asking lots of questions and really trying to understand what it is they're proposing and what's going to be required of the city. And so this has been a really helpful exercise. And so we're here today to really share with you what we've learned in the last few weeks, and in some specific cases, ask for your direction on that. So I'm going to start first, turn this over to Tricia Sorensen, who is the project lead for the La Mesita project.
Good morning. The project for La Mesita, which is owned by New Leaf, the red outline is the property that we're talking about. The project that they're talking about right now is the box on the lower part of your screen, and I think it goes a little bit above the line in the middle to those two buildings above the line. I think those will be included in this raising and renovation project that we've got going on here. It's at 2254 West Main Street. It's in District 3. It's currently used by them for transitional and emergency housing, and they're really talking about looking about half of the site itself for renovation and remodeling and new development. They're going to continue to use the buildings on the other portion of the site for emergency and daycare during the construction. I'm going to turn it over to John after this slide so he can talk about any planning and zoning issues that you may have or questions you may have. They're going to raise the existing buildings and redevelop it. They're going to go to 3 4-story units with about 80 rental units composed in that. They're going to have a clubhouse, a theater, a pool, picnic areas, and potentially a community garden on the site. John, I'm going to turn it over to you. Yeah.
Mayor, Council, excuse me, as stated a minute ago, this has been the Planning and Zoning Board now, and they've given a recommendation for approval. We've been working closely with the applicants for a couple of months using the West Main Street plan and the design objectives there to work with our light rail along Main Street. They've responded very well with their project and created a development that we feel will enhance that West Main Street corridor and begin establishing a transit-oriented development approach in this area. As stated, a 4-story building is being brought out close to the street, and also creating a plaza along the street. We think we'll meet those design objectives. We still need to go to the design review board and begin to look more closely at their actual building elevations, and we think we have a little bit of work to do with them there, but we're pleased with the site plan and anticipate a recommendation for approval on all those things to you when it comes to you at your April 23rd meeting.
One more. Get through all that. So what La Mesita or New Leaf is asking for this project, I think we've covered 3 through 5 with John's discussion of the planning and zoning, but if you have any questions, we can go over those. The one thing that they're asking for is $1.5 million from the city to support this project financially with a 40-year basically no interest rate loan that would be payable at the end of 40 years. One of the things that we're looking at to accomplish this is a New Leaf owned.
Excuse me, Trisha, I'm a little confused. How do you have a 40-year amortization that isn't payable until you're 40?
Sounds like a big balloon payment.
It doesn't sound like that. Yes. So there's really no amortization. It's just a 40-year loan with a balloon payment.
Otherwise, they'd be paying something each year. You're right. The problem with the amortization reference probably is not accurate unless they're willing to pay each year for 40 years. But I think it's they want to pay. I think we're taking this from their application.
Yes, it was from their application.
Oh. Balloon payment?
Balloon payment.
Okay, so there's a balloon payment at the end. So it's really a.
It's really not a balloon payment, it's just a payment above.
Payment principal. In 40 years.
Yes.
Payment
in 40 years.
0% interest.
Okay.
So one of the options we're looking at is that New Leaf does own approximately eight acres of land adjacent to Monterey Park. You see the aerial in front of you. It's this portion right, okay, where's my little thing? Right here in the south. Right here, this portion right here is what New Leaf owns right now. We're getting that appraised to see what the value of that land is. Potentially, we could be looking at an exchange where we give them $1.5 million for the La Mesita project, and we obtain this land.
Isn't that like sort of the same as a purchase, where they just use the proceeds, or it'll be the paperwork will be a little?
Well, we'll have to work on that. They may need to show a contribution.
Gotcha. Okay. But we'll get value. In other words, we'll get value for the $1.5 million.
Right.
So it's not a straight.
Right, Mayor and Council, we are currently undergoing or have an appraisal being done on the eight plus.
It's a little over 8 acres.
Eight acres. Again, this is property adjacent to Monterey Park, a project that was identified in the IMESA effort. It's a Guadalupe or Power in Monterey. So, which is north of Guadalupe.
Yes.
Barely north of Guadalupe.
Just north of Guadalupe on Power Road.
Help me
out, Vice Mayor, anything?
East side of Power Road.
The street there is Guadalupe, and then Power Road is going up that way.
And then that's Monterey.
And it's the south east corner that we're talking about right there.
Got it.
So we're going through the appraisal to see how that values up for that property. And the idea is then there's $1.5 million request from the city. We're going to see how close we get to that $1.5 million. We'll come back to council. Those appraisals,
we're supposed to get the verbal appraisals before the presentation next Thursday. So the 20th.
We may add that into our presentation next Thursday, bring you up to date on the value of the land.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Cool.
The day I'm not here.
Yeah.
That's okay.
The other thing that they're asking for is 30 Section 8 project-based vouchers. We are working with them right now on how that would work. We don't just have a pool of 30 vouchers ready, available right now. So what we would have to do is people come off their vouchers. We would have to designate some of those for project-based vouchers. We actually have a expert on project-based vouchers coming in the week after next to help us formulate that plan and how it would work. But we are confident that we can get the 30 vouchers within the year's time frame, which is what will work for this project.
Vice Mayor?
And they'll discuss any financial liabilities city may have switching over to this? Because I just don't know the process that well.
We will discuss it once we get the plan outlined. We'll probably come back to you with how that's going to work.
The risks, I guess, would be the best thing. Okay, great. Thanks.
And if there are any other questions, that concludes La Mesita.
Councilmember Higgins?
Can you re-explain how the project-based vouchers work differently, just really quick, than regular vouchers?
Okay, Mary, if I
yeah,
speak.
Yeah, I knew that. I saw Mary back there.
Here, Mary.
I know you guys did this last week, but it's...
For our project-based vouchers, it's what you do is we have regular Section 8 vouchers, and then they turn into project-based vouchers for the project. And so there is going to be... an exchange. We only have a certain amount that are given to us. We have about 1,500 vouchers. And out of those 1,500, we can do up to 20% for project-based vouchers.
So, Mary, regularly, the vouchers are basically carried. The voucher goes with the recipient, and they can go to any qualifying property and utilize those vouchers now.
So
on a project base, the vouchers go with the project.
Correct.
And they stay with the project, and the people come in, and whoever is coming in there then qualified by the project, not with the recipient,
right?
With the individual.
Correct.
Okay.
And so some of the issues that we're going to be educated on is the RFP process, the waiting list process, because the pool comes from the Section 8. And so we're trying to get the nuance so we meet, because there's a lot of HUD requirements on this, that we are really in compliance.
And for our friends in Burnaby, Section 8 is a federal program that provides rent subsidies to low-income housing. And they get these vouchers, and they can go to apartment and other properties and qualify for rent-subsidized units. And usually, like I said, those There's several around the city. What we're talking about is allocating 30 of those to a specific project.
I thought it was 8. Didn't they say 8?
That's Section 8.
30.
I'm glad I asked.
30.
Section 30, 8 vouchers in Section 30.
No, don't do that. Stop it. Make it worse.
Okay. I got a little dyslexic.
I'm starting to agree with Mayor Corrigan that things don't operate well before 10 o'clock in the morning.
Sounds good.
Case in point. Go ahead.
So there's 30. Out of how many do we have in the city? Again?
About 1,500.
Okay, so.
It's not.
So
as
No.
And so as they become open, then we would transfer those to the project.
So we could actually have up to 300. If you say 20%?
Yeah.
We could actually have 300 of the 1,500 could be project specific. And we have zero right now.
Zero.
Right? So this would be the first 30.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And typically, out of these 80 rental units, percentage-wise, you would expect people to be using their Section 8 housing anyway, would you think? Or...
Well, that's what we have to do, have to take a look at, because there is a percentage that you can use. It's up to 20% of the housing or 25%. And so there's some requirements as to how much you can really use.
But
and that's what we're going to take a look
at. But La Mesita is not primarily a Section 8 project. It's
no.
a transitional project.
Transitional.
Which makes it very different, right?
Right.
Yes. And yeah, so this isn't your typical Section 8 type of property, which is... This is new for them,
right?
Basically,
and so we're looking at. They would probably use different funding sources. Section A would only be a part of it.
This is just one component,
right?
Right, one component.
Okay. And how many units are there now at La Mesita? There's not this many,
30.
Right? 30 currently.
30.
So you're going to be doubling your size anyway, kind of thing. So you're still always going to have half of your housing.
It's more like tripling the amount of housing.
Fantastic. All right, thank you.
Okay. Any other questions?
Are there any other questions on La Mesita?
No, thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thanks.
Okay, so then we'll turn it over to the project lead for the Escobedo project, Ms. Christine Zelanka.
Mayor.
Good morning, Ms. Zelanka.
Morning, Mayor. It's a pleasure to be here today.
It's a pleasure to have you.
I just wanted to briefly go over the Escobedo project proposal. I put some boards up in the back because it's a little bit hard to see these maps on your iPads. I know this is a little bit difficult for the residents at home to see. But the first slide that you got here, these are basically brownstone looking units with brick facade along University. They enter out onto University, curb separated sidewalk, so there'd be landscaping between the street and the sidewalk. The third panel that Councilmember Summers is looking at there, that's a recent rendering. We will be working with the, I thought you were looking at that. We will be working with the applicant as the property owner in this case to go to design review board on April 4th to really fine tune the design of the units, not only along University, but then the interior units. But what I wanted to jump to was the panel over on the far left.
Can I jump back just real quickly?
Certainly.
I love the step up and the in the design. Can we do that in this project with ADA and everything? Can we have that kind of a step up deal, or are we going to approve a really nice project that all of a sudden has to be ground level, where you don't have the nice step up like they do here?
The back door, right? Yes, they're accessible to the back also. So if we jump over to the fourth panel,
just want to make sure.
Okay. Over to my left. Okay. This is a two-phase proposal, and I wanted to make that clear. The first phase is actually was the application for this year for the tax credits. And the colored sections that you have over there on that last panel along University, north of University, that's the brownstone product. And then if you look up, and it's actually Hibbert is the easternmost street, and Pasadena is the western north-south street in there. The colored area on the east side of Hibbert currently is included in the phase one proposal. The nonprofit campus, including a new office area for United Way, Save the Family, perhaps Helen's Hope Chest, is the area on the south side of University over to the far left there. And what I wanted to clarify, that's kind of straddles both phases. As I understand it, and Brian Swanton is here, and he can certainly come up and help me with this, the improvements on the south side of University will be minimal as far as phase one. There will be no vertical construction on phase one. There will be no demolition of the existing building there, but the eventual building on the south side of University would be contingent upon receiving future year tax allocations. So the plan would be, if they get their award June 1st for this year, they'd start on phase one, then they would apply next year for phase two, which would include the gray area on that map, and then the vertical construction south of University. The other thing that I wanted to make clear was there are existing units, obviously, up there, the old Escobedo, Washington Park neighborhood. Those units on the phase two will not be demolished as part of phase one. The units on the phase one, the colored area, will be demolished and then reconstructed, but the units in the gray area under their current proposal would be left in place until they get the tax financing for the subsequent phases.
I'm a little bit confused because my understanding was that one of the primary reasons for including the area on south of University was to qualify for the half-mile mass transit deal. How do you then go back and apply for phase two when you're outside the half-mile? How do you expect to get that if you're going to? Seems a little bit weird that you're including that twice.
The thing that you need to keep in mind with this is the State Department of Housing changes the qualified allocation plan every year. So next year, you might not even have a half mile requirement. It might be a mile requirement. It might be no TOD requirement whatsoever.
But we're totally at risk then. Depending on how that.
Well,
how
it depends on how they write the qualified allocation plan. Could write it to game the system a little bit to make phase two work.
But then they couldn't. Okay,
so yeah. So,
I guess that's the point I'm making. So this year it has that. Next year we don't know what it is. We're assuming that if there's a successful phase one, that they would want to go to a phase two, but there's absolutely no guarantees that might happen.
That is correct.
Okay. A question out there. Isn't it a little bit disingenuous to take a little piece of property south of University for office building to qualify this entire project when it's outside the half mile? I mean, 90% of this is outside the half mile. Are they going to?
Yeah. It depends on how the Department of Housing looks at it.
Right.
It's going to be their call.
Would they concentrate on the 90% instead of the 10%?
Yeah, we don't have to.
You're darn 10%er.
We don't have to worry about that. It's just
that's so they might
call.
Wait it.
Yeah, that's their
Let
call.
Them figure it
and
out.
My suspicion all along is that the Department of Housing would not qualify this in the half mile because of the reason you raised.
Fair. But they might. They might think it's a good enough project.
You know, Dave, you put too much trust in the state. That's.
Trust me, I don't.
Well, we have these fine people sitting there, and we're doing all the discussion here, and. Are we off base on our questions or our thoughts? Or
Mayor and Vice Mayor, very good concerns, members of the council. We don't believe we're being disingenuous at all. That's not how we operate, and it doesn't fit with our core values as an organization.
Good answer, by the way. I like that.
However, we really want this proposal to be as competitive as possible, and quite frankly, we believe strongly that the opportunity for us to qualify for a phase two development is very strong. We've done, recognizing that the QAP changes from year to year, we've done some preliminary scoring, and we believe that a phase two project would score equally as strongly as our phase one.
Now, is that scoring, your analysis based on the potential success of phase one? Does phase one affect your abilities to get phase two, or are they completely mutually exclusive?
Yeah, no, they're mutually exclusive. There's allocation risk for phase two, but quite frankly, we can't build it out all in one phase. The state caps the allocation at $1.5 million per year per project, and that equates to about $13 million in equity. So you'll see in the 31 applications that came in, the average project size is about 60 units because of the state caps, not because we like building small projects, but because the state caps the allocation. So it's always been anticipated because of the size of this site that we're going to have to build this out in two phases. And there's allocation risk, as Councilman Richens mentioned. There's allocation risk in phase one. You know, we won't know that until June 1. But we're pretty confident that the state is excited about really all the MESA projects that came forward this year.
And if I may also add, one of the advantages of a phase one, phase two is we can double the amount of equity that we bring to the project. So instead of just a $10 million project, we overall, at the end of the day, we'll have $20 million invested in the total footprint of the land.
I guess my only, you know, my concern, and not knowing the details, and having done phase development, you're leaving the buildings there, which I'm sort of mixed on. But how do you? There's going to be front-loaded development issues here, utility relocations, those kind of right. things, that are going to make your phase one more expensive than your phase two. That's all factored into the program?
That absolutely is. All of the infrastructure costs, undergrounding utilities, upgrading water and sewer lines, those types of things, are worked into our project budget. And we're not looking to the city to cover any of those costs. We're not looking for subsidy dollars of any kind. We're building that into the project. And you're right, phase one is larger in size and scope and has more infrastructure and front load expenses. There are points that they give to cost efficiency on projects. If you don't exceed a per unit total development cost, we didn't claim those points this year, largely because of that issue and largely because of the desire of the council and the neighborhood to build the highest quality product possible. And so we're really not skimping on design, quality, materials, infrastructure improvements, largely because we know, you know, those are costs that we're going to have to face. So.
Okay. Councilman Richens?
What other projects similar do you have going to this around the valley right now?
That are going through this current round or
no,
that we've developed in the past?
Developed in the past and under construction.
Well, we have one project under construction, well, really two, the Lofts at McKinley in downtown Phoenix. That's a 60-unit project. It's not phased. It's on less than an acre, so it's 75 units to the acre. A very dense LEED Platinum project for seniors in the Roosevelt neighborhood. Probably the closest example to this would be that I've developed is Rose Terrace in Avondale, which was also an old public housing site that was demolished. It was Maricopa County-owned public housing, and that was developed in two phases as well. And, you know, there is allocation risk, but I think the mayor's right. When you get phase one done and the state's sort of behind that, there really is an impetus to find ways to...
It seemed like they're mutually exclusive, but I can't believe that phase one wouldn't impact positively, a successful phase one wouldn't impact positively phase two.
Right. We lobby the state very aggressively each year to craft a qualified allocation plan that's in the best interest of our partners, our nonprofit partners, and our local government partners. We did that this year. In fact, the 3-mile extension of the light rail into Mesa, New Leaf, and Gorman and Save the Family played a significant role in getting the state to include that extension in the light rail points this year. So, you know, we do our best to try and, you know, encourage the state to include points that'll help, you know, projects like these.
Will the state grant you additional tax credits while you have another project underway if it's not complete yet?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, as long as you're not in default in any way on any state obligations on completed projects or projects under construction, as long as you're on time, on schedule, on budget, you can get two projects per allocation round per developer.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Councilmember Higgins?
My concern is with leaving the gray things are the current Escobedo properties. Correct, which are the ones that have some environmental issues.
They're included, yes.
But they're not going to be demolished in phase one. So that to me is a really big issue because I can't imagine wanting to put more kids closer to that kind of house, you know, run down, dangerous kind of setup in the first place. So, you know, if I was like wanting to support this multi-phase thing, I would really like to see the demolition of all the old cruddy Escobedo properties in phase one. Just so you know.
Councilman Richens?
And this is a great deficiency of bureaucracy because the way that they set up the point allocations, they have to be able to demolish something in the second phase to get additional points. And to me, it's no worse than the existing conditions. I mean, we have buildings that are sitting there, and so they build some more houses, and then there's still buildings sitting there. So to me, it's not the death or a bad thing for this project. But it points to a great deficiency about how we're doing investing tax dollars and tax credit dollars in redevelopment. I mean, I wish those who are doing this would understand this very kind of thing, that sometimes we set up the system to continue blight for an additional year so we can have, you know, a point opportunity the following year, and that's not in the best interest of this project. So it'd be interesting to have that conversation with the State Department of Housing so they could understand that.
Yeah, and I thought the same thing, but I'm mixed because I don't know which is worse, having buildings, at least those buildings are there. I don't know which is worse, having buildings that are boarded up, but they, you know, they have an appearance versus having Site 17, you know, vacant piece of land. And to me, it's six, one half dozen the other, as long as it's kept safe.
Could I just make two quick comments on that? One is, if all goes as planned, we'll be under construction in November on phase one. Our goal is to apply for phase two on March 1st of next year. If all goes well there, then we would be under construction on phase two prior to the completion of phase one. That doesn't always work out that way. I'll be, you know, perfectly frank about that. Sometimes you have to apply in multiple rounds. But that's the goal, is to be under construction on phase two before phase one is even starting to lease up. The second point is that what we talked about with city staff is, and they've been amazing, by the way, is maybe finding a way to do some fence wrap, decorative fence wrap around the non-demolished buildings. So if we are starting to lease up units in phase one, we can have some kind of a graphical fence wrap like you would see at a downtown new construction site that says live, work, play.
You want a good idea how to do a property? Go to the corner of Southern Alma School. Really good example of how you can block off a property. Very attractive.
I'll have to look at that.
Don't even go there. Don't go there.
I mean,
there.
Literally, physically or mentally, don't go there.
Okay.
Go ahead. Vice Mayor.
Talk to him after 10 o'clock about that. I'm just wondering if on that issue, working within the ugly bureaucratic system that exists on that, but yet keeping a mind on what's important, which is public safety in there, if there isn't a way to remediate the hazards within the buildings, particularly the lead and the asbestos that are there. Strip those out in phase one. You can leave the buildings up, but you have to seal them up in that way. That way we can at least we're getting rid of the hazard.
Yeah, if I could speak to that. We have done a lot of work evaluating those buildings. We painted the outside of them to basically encapsulate the lead-based paint. All of the friable or the highly hazardous asbestos on the inside has been removed. So, honestly, the city They are not unsafe at this point in time. The city makes sure that they're boarded up. They're regularly monitored to make sure that nobody's in there. So I think we have gone to significant lengths to make sure they're not hazardous as they're currently sitting there.
From an environmental standpoint, what you're saying is the way they're hazardous is if someone's actually living in them, and no one's living in them.
That's correct.
And they're even because of the remediation efforts that have already taken place, you've even mitigated that. I use remediation and mitigated in the same sentence. That's pretty good.
That's very good, sir.
Big words.
Big words.
That's really been taken care of already is what you're saying.
Right. In fact, our recommendation on disposal of those units, it would not be cost effective to try to go in and remove the lead and the asbestos by themselves. Really, the most cost effective way is to demo them and then what we call burrito wrap them. You throw them in a dumpster, wrap them up in plastic, and take them to the landfill and just treat the whole unit as sort of a low level hazard.
Right.
The cost of going in and removing the asbestos by itself, all we've got in there is mastic, floor tile.
It's
that
contained
kind of thing.
Right now.
It is.
Let me ask you this. If when we go to demolish those buildings, what do we have to do? Can we just bulldoze them and wrap them up, or are we going to have to send in a cleanup team to remove all those hazards before we can bulldoze them?
Mr. Boucher is here, and he can speak specifically to that.
Hi, Scott. It's a good thing we have another Scott.
Yeah.
Good morning, Mayor, Council. At Escobedo, what we did originally, we did an encapsulation of the lead-based paint, so we would have to do some sampling of all of the building materials. There's a process, and I don't want to drop acronyms, but there's a toxic characteristic leaching procedure, which we call TCLIP, that will identify that those building materials aren't considered hazardous waste. So we would do that sampling before demolition happens to make sure that that wouldn't be considered hazardous waste and we could dispose of the building materials. In addition to that, there's the asbestos that's in place. There's lots of floor tile and lots of mastic. There are small amounts of other materials, duct tape, some sealants, those sorts of things. We would have to remove some of those materials that could become friable during the demolition process. The other materials, we would work with Maricopa County to do a demolition in place. Really what you do is similar to what they do with dust control, except you add a surfactant to the water to make sure that you don't have emissions coming off of the site. We'd have an oversight consultant out there, or whoever is doing the demolition would have to have an oversight consultant making sure that they're following the rules. Like Christine said, what they do is they put it into a dumpster that's lined with plastic, with a poly material, and call what we say burrito wrap, wrap it up, and take it to an asbestos landfill for disposal.
But that's all, you know, that's only an issue when we start demolishing buildings.
Right.
Let me ask you the one question, because right now we're confident that they're sealed, it's not a hazard right now. So let me get back to the phase one. As we go through this demolition, is that included in your cost estimates of phase one, and that will be included in the grant amount, the amount that you're doing? You're not expecting the city to do that, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, that was one of the commitments we made in the response to the RFP, is that all infrastructure improvements, all cost of demolition, asbestos abatement would be included in the project budget. We would bring those resources to the table if the city was willing to bring the land to the table.
Okay. So. Vice Mayor? Oh, go ahead.
On a follow-up, Scott, so what you anticipate is that there wouldn't be a separate process of hazard abatement and then demolition, that it would be all in one process?
Right. There's going to be a small amount. It's a relatively small amount of asbestos that would need to be removed demolition happens. But then the rest of it would really be done during demolition. And we had conversations with the county a few years back when we were talking about another demolition project here. In regards to this, and they've bought off on this before, so we have a good relationship with it, but again...
Yeah, but to be clear, you're not... This only is in the case that you're going to demolish the building.
Right.
We're not doing anything right now.
I mean, to make it...
And if this project doesn't go through, we're not doing anything because the situation is stabilized.
Correct.
What you're talking about is if we get to the point where there is development and you're looking at demolishing the buildings, then there will be a two-step process that takes care of the mitigation, right?
The current condition of that property does not present a hazard from an environmental
standpoint. And no action is required, right?
No action is required.
All right.
Mayor, I know we're going to run short on time. There's just really some key issues on this property that we really... There are some infrastructure costs that I understand the city would have to pay for.
Let's get to that.
We need to cover that. The other thing we need to talk about is the request by the developer to control the site for several years, regardless of their successful... funding by the state, and so that we need to know if the council is comfortable with maintaining that commitment, that obligation to the developer. There's a little bit of concern on the staff's part about committing property through multiple rounds if we're not successful in the first round and how that would continue going out into the future. Also, I think we need to be very careful, and I don't know how United Way feels about the parcel adjacent to them and making sure they had an interest in the past about that site to the air west. And so I think the idea that if we were to commit that property to the developer, and I understand phase one, there's no commitment of doing the vertical improvements. I think our relationship with the United Way, we need to make sure at some point, whether it's this developer or somewhere, that property was, you know, kind of in our relationship with United Way, is understanding is that ultimately that would be part of their expansion. So we need to be... That's in the past. Now, the council may have different thoughts about that, but I'm just that.
I mean,
was,
you can can't you include options and other things like that in the deal?
Make
that
sure
that would have a reversion clause and those kind of things in case.
My point is, those would have to be negotiated in the development agreement today. I don't know what impact that may or may not have on the ability of the developer to get points from the state today. But we need to know whether those terms would be comfortable. So, and I think those are the significant issues we need you to be aware of. And make that understanding. Again, One being that developers requesting control of the site for sale for at least 3 to 4 years?
3 to 4 years, I think, is what they're
asking. No guarantee of funding performance. So if they go through this next round and are not successful in getting awarded by the state, they would still have control of the site to go through other additional
this
rounds.
This next round or the round we're currently in?
Both.
This they round would, and in subsequent rounds.
Right. What so, they are requesting, as I understand it, that they would be given exclusive development rights starting when the development agreement is approved in July through the next several years, 3 to 4, if they require multiple years
when
of
When are we
going to
hear from the state as far as the awarding of these?
June 1st. The other thing, if I could just clarify, they need site control of the land, and as I understand it, the definition is either sale or official transfer of deed of the land or long-term lease. Our recommendation as staff is that we would enter into a long-term lease with performance metrics and with the city retaining the rights of master developer.
Options don't work?
Options relative to the lease?
Option purchase agreement with options?
Potentially.
Well, could you look into that?
We can look into that. And I think the idea of the
lease
is...
I don't know what the state requires, but, you know, an option to purchase, a recorded option to purchase is actually more secure for both parties than even a sales agreement or purchase agreement.
Yeah, and that may be one option. We were looking at the lease option so that if they did not...
The option may be an option?
To lease and then possibly to purchase so that if they were not able to get the scoring or they failed to perform, then the city could then gain back...
which is why I like options because options expire or they're extended.
And we can build them either way. You're correct. That's correct.
Yeah, and one of the concepts we were talking about was whether you call it an option or however we craft that is that final transfer of the land wouldn't happen until the completion of phase two so that there would be some protection to the city there. So I'm wanting to make sure we have clear direction relative to developing the or working on the development agreement. So you're open to those concepts of a purchase with.
Let me ask you this: are these, I guess, a very basic question that was probably answered? Are these units all rental units, or are there these are all rental units?
Ownership
units.
15 years with option to own after that 15 years. So for the first.
Okay,
15
so
years,
until 15 years comes up, then having fee simple title is not. Paramount.
Right.
It's not
correct.
Required.
Correct.
It'll be required once you allow
year,
private ownership.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Councilor Fender?
Could we hear from the developer maybe your thought process of why you feel like you need to have that site control and where you're going with that?
Well, Save the Family Foundation has a very generous donor that contributed a significant amount of money to the organization very recently here. To invest in full architectural drawings. In the tax credit world, we don't typically take architectural risk until after an allocation of credits is made. This year, the Arizona Department of Housing requires that you have 100% permit-ready plans by May 1st, as Natalie mentioned. They're not making announcements until 30 days later. So, you know, that puts developers in a real bind in terms of significant investment of cost. Through our partnership with Save the Family and their generous donor, we've decided normally we wouldn't make that risk, quite frankly. With eyes wide open, after educating that donor, he basically said we want to invest in this in this project and make it go. And so at the end of the day, on June 1st, we're going to, you know, have $300,000 to $400,000 invested in this effort and months worth of community work and engagement and a plan that the neighborhood really wants to see happen. If we weren't to get our tax credits, what a shame it would be for us to just have to walk away at that point. I've had projects that got funded on the first round last 2 years in a row. I've had projects that I had to apply for 3 and 4 times. Before they got funded. So it's just the nature of the beast, and we would just ask for some flexibility with performance measurements, but some flexibility on the timeline. It's a complex two-phase project. We're bringing close to $30 million from private equity to the table, but just the process of securing that equity through the tax credit process is very competitive and very capital intensive. So we've just asked for, you know, an extended time horizon to account for the competitiveness of this process.
Well, my concern would be, you know, as we protect the citizens of Mesa with their holdings, you know, you mentioned the performance, you know, standards or agreements. I could see on the first phase, you know, you perform that, but if there's some glitch, and sounds like it's a pretty flexible process, but yet having control for years past, you know, in phase two or whatever, and maybe not the performances, it's a difficult spot for me personally to say, well, I think we've made some of those mistakes in the past, distant past in Mesa, about giving up some of the control. And I've watched our good city manager and staff as we've done all of these different Riverview and other things, we've made sure that it was all performance-based. So it's a pretty hard, you know, it's almost, I don't want to call it a deal killer, but it would be really important, I think, for citizens of Mesa to make sure they're protected and how we proceed with that. So maybe there's some negotiations there.
If I could make one point there, I'm sorry.
Please go ahead.
That's a key point as to the value of the land, the value of the improvements, and the city's position. So that's certainly something that we're going to have to work out in the development agreement to make sure that there's equity there relative to what the city's giving and what the developer is providing in improvements.
Yeah, the value of the exclusivity for a period of time. What the question is, what does the city receive in return for that?
Well, let me ask you. Well, that begs the question on the overall project. I mean, because, you know, we're basically becoming partners in this deal, and I haven't seen, we have issues, legal issues related to whether we can throw land into a project. I would assume that we would need to get some sort of value in return. How you define that value, we haven't heard, and I have no idea what that would be.
And we have identified that as a key issue. We have legal counsel. We've met with the developer, and that's an issue that we're clearly going to have to define and then bring it back to council to explain.
Yeah, and there's multiple ways we can do it, because our driving thing is to get a quality project here. And, you know, if it were left to that, if I could get a great quality project, I'd be more than happy to put the land in. But I don't know that would satisfy the legal requirements we have to get value in return. We just can't go throwing land in just to get a good project. I don't know that that would meet, especially with all the discussion in the state gift clause and all those other things, that would meet that. I know there's multiple ways to define that and to make us whole. That's sort of an open point here that I'd really like to see before we go forward. The other thing is that, is it 3 years, 4 years? Have we talked about it? How long are you asking, or is it more than that? That you'd, you know, like control the property.
I think what would be fair and reasonable is to maybe look at giving us two bites of the apple for each phase.
Okay.
You know, phase one, 2 years, phase two, 2 years.
So if after 2 years, if after two tries on phase one, you don't get it, then the whole thing goes away.
Potentially. Unless.
And if you have phase one funding, then you have two bites at phase two.
Right.
Okay, I get you there. Councilman Richards.
I struggle with this because part of me would really like to see phase two be open again. We had two applicants that applied for this site, and that second applicant brought a strong idea to the table as well. And I mean, I would not be opposed to people looking at phase two and letting that be a little competitive. So I'm not sure if I'm all excited about an exclusive negotiation period now, when we could even upgrade the project further in a round two there with added competition. But I don't know. That's
well, that to me, that really, though, raises the issue. I mean, how do you compete on phase two when you've already sort of put phase one in? It seems like phase two would have to conform with the design that and the layout that you
sure,
do in phase one.
But I think developers can recognize that kind of thing. I mean, it's basically a master site. It's like a big subdivision. When you're you'll have a master developer like DMV is creating neighborhoods, and then they're going to turn around and sell that to individual builders that are going to build different neighborhoods on the different lots.
But what they do though is they define the standard up front,
right?
And so it gets back to your question: if we think we can do better, then why are we moving ahead right now with this?
No. I'm not saying that. I don't think we can do better. I think this is a good project. I really do. I think this is a good project, and I'm supportive of it. But in the phase two, having additional market competitions on phase two, it raises the bar for everybody. Competition does that. That's why people praise it so much. And having a little competition on phase two for them to develop. You know, even if it's a little bit different than looking than this neighborhood, I don't think that's a bad thing to have a little variety added into it. But they know that the site will be defined as whatever you see in the gray boxes over there. I just don't know that an exclusive period gets us anywhere. You know, they can compete for phase two just like everybody else.
Mayor?
I don't disagree with that. Let me sort of play devil's advocate. I think on the other hand, you have a party that's stepping up and taking the risk now. And I don't think they're doing it to do a 60-unit project. And I think in some ways, well, I don't disagree with you on the premise that competition, you have to take into account that there is a party that's making the investment, and therefore they should have the opportunity. That should warrant something. That should merit the first shot at the second phase, because they're the ones that stepped up now.
But doesn't this project have to perform financially on its own? I mean,
it does. I'm not saying it doesn't.
Phase two requisite on, I mean, they're not tied together in that way. They have to perform from a, because the tax credits are going to be syndicated to, could be two different parties.
Yeah.
They have to perform financially.
They do have to perform independently financially as a standalone project. There are all sorts of operational issues, though, when you get into two phases of this virtually the same project with two separate development partners, with competing management operations and competing for leasing, and it would be not advisable. I mean, I'm self-interested in saying that, of course, but you know, we went into this with 124 unit focus, and the operational efficiencies are so much greater.
Well, couldn't you do affordable on this phase and market rate in the next phase?
Market rate, we've looked at market rate.
If it was quality enough?
You just can't. If you look at the market study that we put together for our tax credit application, market rate is tax credit rents, and we can't get it financed. You'd have to come in with literally millions and millions of dollars of private equity without tax credits at tax credit rent levels. It's just not financially feasible.
And that's true. It's tax credit projects are the ones getting the financing in the market right now. So
the market just isn't there.
But what does it look like in a year from now?
Well, I mean, and that's the decision we're making. We're deciding to move ahead in an uncertain market because we have people that have stepped up and put money in and taken a risk on a quality project. If this project isn't to the quality we need, then we shouldn't be doing it at all. I believe that if it is the quality and we decide that this is a company we can work with and will bring the kind, whether it's one phase, two phase, they have stepped up and cut a check. They've put the effort in. I mean, the other company will do great things. They weren't willing to do that or didn't have the time to do that. Whatever the reason was, they set out this thing. We have a party that stepped up and is acceptable. I think that someone who steps up and makes that kind of investment should be given a chance or the inside track to avoid. I don't think it's fair to have somebody take the upfront risk, put money in, and then open it up and let other people basically play off that. Now, I don't believe in an unlimited. I like the idea of two shots at the apple, because that's not that long. You know, you're talking not really a two-year process. You're talking about a one-year exclusivity, because you got two shots. One happened right now. The next one will happen next March. So by next June, which is 14 months from now, we'll know whether they have an exclusivity or not. So it's not really a five-year or a 10-year. It's really a 14-month exclusivity on phase one. And if they're successful that, then it would be another 14-month exclusivity, because even though we say 2 years, that 2 years begins right now, because I guess it's not 14 months. Next one would actually be about 24 months, because they would apply the following March for phase two, and then they'd have one, that would be 2014. So it would be maximum to 2015. So the exclusivity would be actually less than 3 years for both phases, and 14 months for the first phase.
Mayor, you may have already suggested the answer. If we use the same model that we used on Riverview, it's performance-based options. I don't know. That seemed to work really well.
No, I'm thinking the same thing, Mayor, Councilman Pinter. I think part of the dilemma, and I understand what the developer's trying to maximize the first phase, is the first phase, if you look at the phasing and the properties that are being built out, they're taking the best properties. And so, you know, phase two, if they don't perform it and we have to go to someone else, that could be somewhat problematic, but maybe there's ways to negotiate the consideration in phase one that if they don't do phase two, maybe there's, you know, we got to make it work for us too. I understand the developer's putting a lot at risk. We're at risk for having nothing happen in phase two and having that property sit there. And over time, from whether it's code or police or whatever it is, that becomes a liability for us too. So I think there's a balance here. I think the fact that the land is being requested at no cost makes us a significant partner. And I think the fact that we own all the property and it's a highly visible area, it's been talked about in the community for a long time about the future of that. I think that we've got, the developers got to meet us part of the way on this. And I understand they've got risk, but that's part of being a developer. Being a community isn't necessarily accepting a lot of risk, but I think this council, you've given us permission to do some of that, and I think we've got to, we're putting all our property into this, so yeah, we're at risk.
But saying this property is given at no cost is hard to say too, because there's some significant site preparation costs that have to go into making this development ready. You know, the demolition of
but those are
property. Those are covered.
I mean, this isn't turnkey property. This isn't very.
No, but we're not talking about infrastructure costs that any other developer wouldn't be responsible for.
Right.
I would agree with you on the demolition of the existing buildings. That obviously is something we've wanted to do for some time. So I would agree with that. The infrastructure cost to me.
Well, we're not bearing that cost. I mean, they were just told us.
No, I'm just answering his point. I mean, that's our benefit.
Here's the other thing with this project. I mean, let's put this in context. This is not a primo top level property that we own that I would be more than willing to say, developer, you take all the risk. We're not going to take any of it because this is a primo property. We need to take some of the risk because our objective is not to maximize return on investment. Our objective is to get a quality project that builds up the neighborhood, and this is not, you're gonna have to share that risk because this is not a property, as we've heard, that a developer is willing to come in and take the market risk on because the market risk is excessive. You can't get market rent rents. You can't finance except for with tax credit. So you know there's a little bit of give and take. This isn't totally a developer. You show up, you got to take all the risk. We can't accomplish that, or else that property will sit there like Site 17 has.
And that's why I suggest
20 years from now we'll still have those buildings sitting there on that. So we've got to be in the mode that recognize that we've got to give, they've got to give, because
and
the objective is different than
me. I think I was only suggesting there needs to be a little bit.
Well, I think you've got direction on. You've seen that, heard the concerns, and you can talk about it when you're in development agreement.
The one other caution I want to throw in is the Department of Housing Qualified Allocation Plan is going to have specific language that defines what site control is, and we may think an option, performance-based option, sounds good in our meeting here, but if it doesn't meet the definition that the Department of Housing has for site control, then we're not going to be able to do it. So I just want to make sure people understand that. You know,
well, that's why we talked about
a different approach.
That's why we're talking about options and other things and finding out
how it's defined.
Yeah,
but I don't think the council is interested in us not having any recourse for lack of performance.
Right. What we'd like to find out, and we brought up options and long-term.
Yeah, we're going to talk about.
Apply those against the standard Councilman Richens is doing and see what we can do and come back to us. And then the council can decide as a policy matter if that is a risk we want to take.
Right.
Because if control means that we give up total control, this council, what I've heard, may not want to take that much risk.
Agreed.
If there's a midpoint, we don't know what that midpoint is. That's a policy decision I think we'll need to make once we get more information on exactly what that definition is and how we can balance those two. Does that sound okay?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. Sure. All righty. The rest of the stuff, I think we've covered it. I think we know the numbers in that. And I see it. Great slides. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. All righty. Thank you.
So moved.
All right, we have a motion to from the Vice Mayor to accept minutes of various boards and committees. We have a second. Councilman Kavanaugh, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Motion carries. Reports on meetings, conferences attended. Anybody want to talk about anything real quickly? Okay, Mr. Brady.
I think we'll see you the next study session next Thursday.
All righty. Ms. Crocker, any requests to speak?
Request me.
All right. We have a motion to adjourn from Councilman Richens, second Councilman Fenter. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
We are adjourned. Hope all those who can make it go down to Station 201 for a little get-together with Burnaby, a pancake breakfast, right now. Thank you.